start, and I'll tell you why now. And it's also extremely lucky. I think it's an exciting stage for Meerkat and Scott. And I've asked you to tell you what his involvement is. He's easy to start with, and I wasn't sure what the connection was, so he's going to tell you. So let me tell you about him. Starting from the bottom before the start of Meerkat. He has a BSc from UNISA from 1996. In 1997, he was BSc honors at UCT. In 1999, he got his master's at the University of UCT. And in 2004, so he's very young too, but he got his PhD from the Strong Laboratory for Space Research at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. And then he started in 2004 as a junior researcher at the University of Utrecht in Strand, I'm not sure what that stands for. And then in 2004 he became a research fellow at the South African Antarctic Research Center, the National Observatory, South African Observatory, I mean, I read this one, but I didn't see the name of it. And in 2007 to 2008 he was a postdoctoral student at UCT, and now, from 2009, he is a senior lecturer, so I think he started. He's also, his research interests are observational constraints on dark energy, SMBs and their remnants, galaxy clusters and galaxy evolution, and HR surveys. And he has publications for such, there are 21 refereed journal publications, and non-refereed 52 CPET, which I don't know. Announcements and the conference proceedings. So I think you have a true scholar here, and please welcome him.
Sure.
I ask that you're speaking at least a foot away from the microphone. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got one of these, so I don't know if that's going to be.
Can I just start by saying that I don't mind taking any questions during the lecture, so if anything's unclear or I'm saying something obviously very stupid, just stop me and ask me to clarify. I'll try and do that if I can. I was asked to talk about the SKA and Meerkat. I'm involved in Meerkat through one of the large science projects of Meerkat, together with a colleague. And then I'm also involved in one of the science working groups with the SKA. And so I was asked to give an overview of the progress of the SKA and also South Africans that have been involved by the Meerkat. So what I plan to do today is just to talk a bit about the SKA, a little bit about, I can only touch on these topics, on the technology and the science cases. And then move over to Meerkat, talk about some of the large science projects that's been approved with Meerkat. Talk about the construction progress and about the Meerkat Human Capital Development Program and the progress for that. And I'll probably run out of time, so if I do have time, I'll touch on this newer project that sort of comes through because of Meerkat, this African VRBI. Okay, so what is the square SKA? It stands for square kilometer away, and that is basically one square kilometer of collecting area. The square kilometer away will be about 50 to 100 times more powerful than any current radio telescope. We know it will be built somewhere in the southern hemisphere, either South Africa or Australia. These are the two short listed sites. It will cost, and this is probably the big attraction to South African and Australian governments, it will cost about 1.5 billion euros to build and about 160 million euros per year to operate. And a large fraction of this will be spent in Australia and probably contract out
lots of local industries to do the building, they have the fibers, computing resources, and so forth. And then at least 30% of the stocks will be dedicated to the to ICT. So that's things like laying optical fibers, because it will be very computing intensive to analyze all this data. We have to construct large computers, especially considering that they'll be producing something like on the order of petabytes of data per day. And these petabytes, I think we're actually going to look this up. It's something, it's a, like, can you remember correctly, it's a billion gigabytes. So, it's like, you know, that's a billion DVD movies on worth of data per day. So we really need to have a leap up in the ICT and computing infrastructure. The idea for that is for the SKA came about because we want to observe gas, hydrogen gas, as neutral hydrogen in very distant galaxies. Now, hydrogen is most abundant in the universe. It's a fuel for galaxy formation, for star formation. And so it's a very important note of tracking the galaxy as a function of time, as a function as, you know, as you can see, evolves, we know what happens to that nuclear hydrogen and how it forms stars, how it forms galaxies. But hydrogen, neutral hydrogen, is a very good frequency note. And so we can only observe neutral hydrogen in a very low frequency. So you have to go orders of magnitude larger in technology in order to detect the hydrogen further. So I think the current radio telescope technology dates back to the 1960s and 70s. And so we really need to think of new technology to solve the science and look. Many existing facilities have upgraded the instrumentation, but really this the upgrade is coming again. Now what we need now is more dishes or more collecting area. We really need more hardware. And so this really need this large increase in sensitivity of a factor of about 100 is needed, also to keep up with developments in other wavelengths. So in other areas like optical astronomy or high energy astronomy, X-rays, they've been making lots of advances, and so if radio astronomers keep up with that, they need to sort of push your high sensitivity, and that means more collecting area. But this comes with huge challenges. The challenges are the cost, and so no one country can go as long as it has to be a national consortium. At the moment, with the financial situation, that's, the outlook is not that great. So scientists really are really working very hard to get this funding together. Having a large frequency coverage, so covering almost the entire radio regime, is very difficult. You have to have different instrumentation to cover different radio frequencies. And so if you want to cover the only one of them, you really have to come up with some new ideas. And then there's also this growing amount of man-made interferences in the radio waves, so things like cell phones, television signals, so that corrupts your observations. So really, a new technology shift is required to achieve the objectives of the SKA. So going back to a few decades, some of the state of the art were these single dish radio telescopes. A few meters in diameter. What happens, much like the optical telescope, the radio waves come in, they reflect it off this dish, and they receive in this radio receiver a vector focus over there. Now, the sensitivity of the radio telescope goes with the area, so that's the square of the diameter. As you're going to increase your sensitivity, you have to increase the diameter of your dish. And so you go from something like this little telescope up to the receiver. So this one's a few meters in diameter, going to the receiver, which is limitations of the receiver is that it's not steerable, so you have to work with objects over and the electric jets. But you can still get to the sensitivities that you need with the SK, and you need many, many, many of these types of issues. Another drawback with radio astronomy is that the resolutions of how finely you can image something goes as a wavelength over the diameter. And if you compare the radio wavelengths with optical wavelengths, the radio wavelengths are talking about something like the orders of meters, centimeters, and the optical is talking about a few hundred nanometers. And so it's a factor of a few tens of thousands more. And so if you want to build a telescope, a radio telescope, for the resolution of optical telescopes, you have to have a telescope that's about 45 kilometers in diameter. And that's clearly, the current technology is impossible. And so a way of getting around that is something called interferometry, where you can basically string up all these a number of smaller dishes, and they're connected by optical fiber, and all the signals are correlated, and so each of these dishes are connected by optical fiber, and the signals are analyzed with some specific hardware or with computers. And with this you can essentially get a large telescope that can give you the resolution equivalent to a diameter that spans the maximum baseline between the furthest dishes.
What is the main wavelength you're going to be using? 21 centimeters?
21 centimeters will be a very important number.
But
other wavelengths too? Other wavelengths too. And so we would come basically 21 centimeters and higher. Well, either side of that spectrum. But the original idea for the SMA was to measure the 21 centimeter signal. But yet, I really, I'll show a few slides. The science projects had since grown, and so other frequencies are very important as well. Okay, so the SKA will follow very much this approach of interferometry. Interferometry brings its own complexities with it, because you don't image the sky directly. What you get are these interference patterns, and those have to be analyzed and then converted into images. So it becomes very computing intensive, especially with a growing number of dishes.
What is the diameter of those dishes?
So these dishes are from the VLA, a very large array in New Mexico and the US. And they are about 20 centimeters in diameter. The large single dish telescopes are between 60 to 100 meters in diameter. Okay, so in order to get this square, or this million square meters over 1 square kilometer of collecting area, with the current technology, you're going to have to employ a combination, probably a combination of dishes and what's called these aperture arrays. Then these aperture arrays are very much like television aerials, so that's stuck in the ground, and then linked up in the same way that you linked up the dishes. Also, there's going to be, have to be a huge increase in the computing power and software. At the moment, we don't have that capability yet, but the projection is that in 10 years' time, when the SKA really starts doing science, that the computing power will have gone down. You have to do the signal processing, and then the sort of SKA project is very complex with many parts. You have to get power lines into the site between optical fiber, you have electronics, you have science, all that. So you have to have a very detailed systems engineering approach. So people will create models or simulate things and see if they can get it right before they have to go ahead and start building this. So these are artist impressions of what the SKA data might look like. So they're thinking of having 15-meter diameter dishes. And these are for the higher frequencies, so 21 centimeters. front. And then the lower frequencies are these aperture rays, so these are dipoles. So the lower frequencies and the mid frequencies, you have these spreads. Okay. So these look very much like the DST satellite dishes, and these very much like the old television antenna from part of the aerials. So the dish array component will consist of 3,000 dishes. They said they will be 15 meters in diameter, and compare them to the current large arrays, the VLA in the US and the DMFT in India. VLA has 27 dishes at 25 meter diameter, the DMFT 30 dishes for 25 meter diameter. You can see factor of 100 more dishes, but a bit smaller than this. And the reason we're going for these smaller dishes is to keep them in a manufacturing cost down, and also the manufacturing and operating costs, and also do have rapid installation of these. And so installing smaller dishes are much easier than installing larger dishes. Then if we have to install 3,000 of them, we have to have a much easier way of dealing with this. Another reason for going for smaller dishes is that with the smaller the dish, the larger the fuel of view that you get. So the fuel of view is the amount of sky that you image at one particular time. So with a smaller dish, you can image a larger area of sky. With the larger dish, you decrease your fuel of view. And so with the 15 meter dishes, we'll get about 1 degree fuel of view, instantaneous fuel of view, and you compare that to the HST, which is much smaller. The full moon is about 0.5 degree in diameter, so the full moon will be that size. And so this really helps with surveying the entire sky in a much shorter time. So if you want to achieve this objective of getting obtaining galaxies. So this is just a little video clip of what the answering question of what the dish array would look like.
What are the dishes made of?
We don't know yet. These are only, there are many different suggestions, and they're still working on different technologies.
very new ideas. They are innovative and cost effective. And the bigger and large we look good as well, because they're not directional, so you can get signals from all over the site. And you have to use different software, use our computer programs, you have to do your imaging. And so this is a little cartoon of this aperture release. You get signals from all over the sky, and then you would, in computer correlation, you'd have to do the form these beams to any object you want to use, you want to observe. And so you can do many different size projects potentially at the same time, simultaneously. But that's part of the experience of having the computing resources. The software and the computing is a very important component of the SKA project. And it's needed to, you have to remove data that has been corrupted. You have to calibrate each antenna. So if you have thousands of antenna, that becomes a very daunting task. Traditionally, people who do this by hand, or by eye, an observer or a scientist will go through this and calibrate this antenna, remove corrupted data. But when you're dealing with these scales of arrays, you have to do it automatically, and we still have to get the correct or efficient algorithms that can do this. And then because, as I said, you're not observing the sky, you're not imaging the sky directly, you have to convert the data that you're getting into images, and that's also quite complex, and then you have to clean up these images, because when you convert from the data that you're getting into the sky image, you get all these artifacts, and then you have to clean for those as well. And in order to do this, the SKA the central computers would need the performance of something like 100 petaflops per second, and that turns out to be 50 times more powerful than the current supercomputers, or these are equivalent to about 1 billion pieces in quantum that we find that all. So we're really hoping that we can keep doing Moore's law and that we can get out there by 2020. So just to give you an example, this is data that was taken with the first 7 MIR packages that's in testing. And what you get out are these fringes and these, well, don't have to get out these fringes, you just get out a whole lot of numbers. And you have to convert these into images, and that can be quite a complex procedure. Okay, so on to some of the science that will be done with the SKA. So originally it was thought of as being a hydrogen cluster in order to detect this 21 centimeter from Milky Way type galaxies out to a redshift of 1. So the redshift of 1 is roughly about half the age of the universe. But since then the SKA science case has become much broader, and it's really going to be following a multi-wavelength approach, so we won't just be looking at the radio data on its own, but we're going to be combining this with data from other wavelengths, such as optical or infrared, gamma ray. There's huge amounts of ongoing technical development. We're really entering this era of big data, and there's going to be huge databases where people can get access to their data and also to data from other wavelength range, and a project of this size cannot be undertaken without a large amount of international collaboration involved. Okay, so these are some of the current most important questions in astronomy. I've taken this from a document from a European astronaut document of what they viewed as the important questions for astronomy. In cosmology and fundamental physics, it's questions on the size of gravity. Was Einstein correct? Does gravity load? Can you go looking at very high or strong fields? Cosmic magnetism. Things like, how do galaxies fall? How do they evolve? Where do these metals come from that we see in stars and in galaxies? And then questions like, how does planets form? Is there life on planets elsewhere? And a number of these topics are actually also the key SCA site questions. So there are five key topics, and I'll just briefly go through the five of them. One of them is trying to image the first objects that we call. And this is a cartoon illustrating the current accepted theory of the evolution, the creation evolution of the universe. So you start off with a big bang over there, which we have on this axis of time. So you have the big bang, things are very hot, and then they cool down, and then you have your first stars and black holes forming, and things evolve along here until what you can see currently. All these beautiful galaxies out there, but we really don't know very much about what's going on in this period of the Earth. And hoping that with the SCA, we'll be able to image some of the first objects that are forming and actually find out where this line is going, where things actually start forming on this timeline. Another question is, as you can see, the initial universe expands very rapidly. Then you go to this state of sort of steady, nice and easy expansion. But more recently, what we found out about a decade ago, it seems that the universe's expansion of the universe is accelerating. And we don't know why it's accelerating. And the only explanation that we can come up with now is that there must be some mysterious force that's driving this acceleration. And so that is also one of the key questions for the SCA is, what is this dark energy? And here dark really refers to our ignorance, because we have no idea what it is. At the moment, we can only hope to try to characterize it, but we still probably have a way of understanding what it really is. So this dark energy really acts as an anti-gravity, where gravity attracts things, but this dark energy is repelling things. So I've heard people refer to it as being the stuff that makes the universe repulsive. And so it's really only 4% of the universe is made of this, it's known as baryonic matter, so the ordinary matter that we know, things that you now made of, things in this lecture theater, really only makes up 4% of the universe. And then 21% of the universe is in this dark matter, which I'll get to a bit later. And then the largest component is dark energy. And so something like 96% of the universe is in the form that we have very little understanding of. Another area is magnetism in the universe. So magnetic fields are everywhere in the universe. You find them in planets, stars, you find them on galaxy scales, and even larger. And so understanding of where these magnetic fields arise from and what the effects are. Do they have a role in stabilizing galaxies? What are the role of magnetic fields in star formation or galaxy formation? It's still very poorly understood. And so the SKA will make detailed sort of 3D maps of many galaxies, and hopefully we can understand a bit more about the influence of magnetic fields. Another very interesting question is the study of gravity. And here scientists are to use things called pulses, which are these very compact, very massive objects that are spinning at a few of these signals at very regular intervals, the orders of fractions of a second. And you're hoping to find a pulse going around a very massive object, like a black hole, and you can look at the distortions in this time and can tell you something about the way gravity acts in this situation. Einstein's theory is probably one of the most tested theories, the theory of gravity, and today it's stood up to all tests, but we haven't really tested it in very extreme environments, and so this is a very important project as well. And then everybody's favorite question probably is there evidence of life elsewhere? So with the SCA, you hope to be able to detect molecules, including molecules that would be precursors to life or molecules that are necessary to sustain life in other planetary systems. And also, possibly by chance, to detect any extraterrestrial signals. Because things like
radio signals, cell phone signals, television signals are very clearly differentiated. Between these man-made signals and signals that are coming from an astronomical source. So if you do find a strange signal, you'd easily be able to tell if it was man-made or not. So the timeline to the SKA is this low the concept started the idea. They formulated in 1991. 2006, they shortlisted the sites. There were five possible candidates, and they cut that down to two, Australia and South Africa. Currently busy with the telescope systems design and costing. Last year, they established the SKA organization as a legal entity with their offices in Manchester in the UK. The site selection we promised will be made this year, so I think by next month the site allocation, site selection committee will give the report to the organization, and hopefully a decision will be made within a few months of that.
Who are the people who have the great say? I mean, are any politicians involved?
To be honest, I'm not sure who exactly has the final say in this. But the funding is all coming from governments, and so probably ministers, science ministers will have a large say in where the SKA goes. So advice in the end cannot be a political decision. But I cannot speculate on that. The phase one construction, phase one would be something like the 20% of the full SKA. The construction is planned to start in 2016, and phase two construction will start around 2018, and then getting into full sites of the phase one by 2020, and the complete SKA array by 2024. The location, as I said, it's either between South Africa, it's between South Africa and Australia. The number of selection criteria that comes into it. Things like the radio frequency interference from mobile phones, TVs, and other electrical devices. And this is a satellite image, I can't remember what frequency per second, showing the radio image coming from there. So these are all man-made signals, so from cell phones or television signals. And you can see most intense over the long areas with high population densities, Europe, the US, and China, whereas over in South Africa and Australia, you don't have that much radio pollution. And so that's also besides just the southern sky and the access to the center of our Milky Way, it's also the radio quiet nature of these sites. Other factors will come into the atmospheric conditions, because the upper atmosphere also influences the path of the incoming radio waves, and that can blur the images. Your climate and the temperatures, infrastructure costs, how much does it cost to lay the power cables, how much does it cost to get optical fiber to the site, operational and maintenance costs, and then also the long-term sustainability of the site as it requires. So really looking at what are the chances that people will start moving into those areas and wanting to use cell phones and television.
The government has guaranteed a radio-free area.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go to Scar Mount, if you go to Canal Dam, there's just outside Cap 7, there's no cell phones allowed.
That's right.
The government around the Scar site has guaranteed it. Something like 98,000 square miles where they've said nothing.
Yeah, it's really quiet. It's
Yeah.
And it's something similar in Australia as well. Yeah. They have this also guaranteed. Yeah. It's really quiet reserve. So the SKA in Africa, the core site will be in the Peru. But these baselines will spread over a few thousand kilometers, and for the South African bit, there are eight other African partner countries going as far as Ghana. For those Australians, the proposed site in Western Australia
And yeah, I mean, kind of going all the way all across Australia, even up to New Zealand. Okay. So, so each of these the satellite sites aren't, they're not just one dish over there, but as we've seen in this video, they're actually, you know, a number of dishes, so they have little supplements at these remote sites. So this is what the central core would look like. So we're going up in distance from the core. So, at those sites you need mostly trained technicians and staff, technical staff that can do the maintenance on those things, and if anything more complicated or more involved needs to be done, you know, you could have people flying out from either South Africa or Europe or so. So, you'd have to, the cheapest would be, and the most attractive would be to have local people trained to actually look after those sites. And then the question I had is, well, what this site, well, what the array layout will be like. It's quite possibly will be sort of a spiral structure, but this spiral structure you're going to really see from distances, with over distances of about 3,000 kilometers. The central cause, I suspect that the layout wouldn't be that important. Okay, so onto the South Africa's bid for the SKA. So the question is, what is Meerkat? So both South Africa and Australia have been shortlisted to OCSKA, and both countries are building pathfinders. To demonstrate that they have the capability of doing this. And so they are sort of much smaller versions of the SCA. South Africa's Pathfinder is called the Meerkat. CAT stands for the Karoo Array Telescope. So initially they had funding only for a few telescopes, and then they got more funding from the government for the expand, so they get many more telescopes. And so it became Meerkat, so Meer for more. These pathfinders will be world class instruments in their own right. So Meerkat, for example, will be the most sensitive centimeter wavelength instrument in the southern hemisphere. And that it will be eventually be remotely used, and the head offices in Cape Town, everything will be controlled from here, and you'll just have a few support staff in the code. The Meerkat Operations and Science Center is already set up in Cape Town, so they have offices in Islands, and they're working towards actually having this remote observing from the Islands offices. And then they have recently installed this dedicated 5 million paper to the Guru. The Meerkat array will consist of 46 dishes, round about 13.5 to 15 meter diameter. Say 13.5 to 15 meters because they're not quite circular. So it will be 13.5 in one direction and 15 in the other axis. And the maximum baseline would be about 8 kilometers. The location is in the Karoo, close to Carnarvon, somewhere between Cape Town and Johannesburg. That's what the site looks like. Probably what you should notice here is that there are no people around, so no cell phones. And then also these mountain ranges provide natural protection from radio signals from outside the area. As a gentleman pointed out earlier, then this area over here has been declared a astronomy reserve, so a radio quiet reserve. It also includes restrictions on optical pollution, so there'll be protection for The scale we get this measure shows the color coding shows the population densities going from areas of tens of thousands of people per square kilometer down to between 0 to 2 people per square kilometer in the gray area. So you probably find many more sheep out there than people. And you know, this, I remember that it's in June 2008, where this appeared in the Government Gazette, that this area has been declared an astronomy reserve, and it's been close cooperation with the broadcast and telecom operators, and protects, as I said, radio and other people's astronomy. So in the middle of March 2010, there was this call for large projects with MEAC. It was open access. They received many proposals from the international community. The decision was made in September 2010, and there were a number of key sites themes, or key sites projects were selected. This access is not completely free because these large teams are expected to contribute in terms of the software simulation and this helping to get the specifications for the array. So the highest priority, and this is no surprise because it aligns very nicely with the key signs for the SKA, are this deep neutral hydrogen observations and then this radio pulse timing observations for studying the effects of the sonic gravity in these large field environments. And these two, can't remember how much time it was ordered, but something on the order of a few years of observing time. And then a number of other projects as well were awarded, and these were listed as very important, but slightly less compelling than the high priority ones. Things like mapping of some nearby galaxies, continuum surveys, looking at radio transients, so objects that basically go bump in the night. Except for the radio, you can observe them anytime. Doesn't matter day or night. And then also looking at the VLBI, so very long baseline photography. There's these correlated signals from telescopes all over the world. Then also looking at magnetic fields on the scale of galaxies. And so there was a huge national interest in the MEAC call for proposals. As can be illustrated by this graph over here. So the blue bars indicate the number of individuals. So really, the institutes. So see. Quite a large involvement from people in South Africa, in the UK as well, lots of interest, and then in places like the US and even Australia. This is quite strange because we are competing with Australia to those SKA, but we also have very close collaboration with them. So, on terms of science and projects, there are lots of overlaps. There are many Australians on the MEAC teams, and there are many South Africans on the Australian. ASCAP or Australian Pathfinder teams form. So what will we be able to do with MEAC? As I said, MEAC is, or will be, the most sensitive radio telescope in the southern hemisphere. And what's plotted over here is your intensity of the radio signals. What we're looking at is the number of active galaxies over here. And so these are galaxies very active black holes in the centers. And these black points are the observed galaxies. And as you can see, as you go around to fainter signals, the data becomes very sparse. And so it's not very clear what's happening out in this area over here. But with MEAC and also the Australian array, you can push up to much lower flux densities, and the SKA will be. Also, one of the high priority projects with Meerkat is looking at this the neutral hydrogen gas in galaxies. So the points we're getting in this graph is the amount of neutral hydrogen at different ratios. So as a hydrogen back, or as the distance from us, so also looking back in time, so this can be quite distance at time. So this is where we are currently, and if you look back in time, these are the observations that we have of the neutral hydrogen. The black lines are models of what we expect, what some people expect should be happening with neutral hydrogen. These points on here come from direct detections with current radio telescopes. These points over here are indirect detections using other frequencies like the radio frequencies, and that's why because they're not direct detections, they have much larger error bars associated with it. And with Meerkat, we've been able to push out and get measurements over here, and you can see if our models, our understanding, current understanding, really agrees with the data. One of the compelling science cases with the Meerkat is imaging many local galaxies. So these things, which stands for the H1 nearby galaxy survey, which was done with the VLA in New Mexico. They imaged on the order of 30 or 40 galaxies, nearby galaxies. And the proposal is to do something similar with the Meerkat, but at a larger scale. And one of the things that you're able to do with these the data from survey like this is you can look at the velocities in these galaxies, and this velocity curve is derived from one of these galaxies. And as you can see, from the central part going outwards, this velocity picks up and then sort of stabilizes and stays flat. Now, if the amount of matter correlates with the amount of hydrogen that you see, this curve should actually be coming down. But it doesn't, it continues flat. And so the interpretation is that there must be lots of unseen matter out there. It's probably not weak for diffuse hydrogen. It's orders of magnitude more than the visible matter. And the current thinking is that it must be in a form that we're not familiar with. So again, the dark nature of things coming, it's been termed dark matter. And in order to understand that, we have to get better observations of galaxies like this, especially going to the outskirts of galaxies where you see the emission intensity decreases. It's not very clear what is happening on the outskirts of these galaxies. And so these observations will be used in order to parameterize this dark matter. This mongoose is a project that I just mentioned. It's the Meerkat's equivalent of the Things galaxy without the VLA. So the Things observations took 500 hours. They got 34 galaxies. And they did it in different with the VLA, you can reconfigure the array, so you can get it in different configurations. And they did 7.5 hours per galaxy in the one configuration and about 4 hours in now the two configurations. So how does Meerkat stack up with this? We can do the same thing in the same amount of time. We can get to the same sensitivity as a VLA B array, but we get this C and D array included for free. And so we can do the same study essentially in sort of half the time. Another project is the Thundercat, which stands for the Meerkat Transient Peace Science Project, and this is these guys will be looking, they'll essentially be looking at everybody else's data and looking for any strange signals in dark, that, you know, so you're looking for periodic signals, signals that the stars that flare up, that could be in binary systems, so mass falling onto a very compact object and there are flares coming off of that. Things like gamma ray bursts, or supernovae going off. And so they're hoping to be detecting many more, many of these systems. Okay. So, just going to end off with this, the construction, and then a little bit on the human capital development aspect of the Meerkat. So Cat 7 is the first 7 dishes that is constructed. It's basically a precursor to the SCA precursor. It's a precursor to Meerkat, and it's built to be able to test our software, the engineering, and also the construction of the dishes, which I'll show you shortly. This is the on the site in the Karoo. This is a shed where they actually constructed dishes, and in these containers over there, you have lots of electronic equipment. In future, this complex will be extended, so that the dish assembly area will become larger. Get another workshop in the back, and then also they'll build a large bunker processing building where you have all the electronics and computers, and this will be underground because the electronics produce their own radio signals as well. And so you have to shield these, and one way is by going underground. The entire dish was built and assembled in South Africa. So these are the pedestals and some of the gear drives for the Cat 7 dishes. These were constructed in Johannesburg, then transported down to the Karoo. And there's one of these pedestals that was erected in the Karoo. Lots of the electronics again will go inside the pedestal, and that's again to be off shield of the radio interference that's coming from this equipment. One of the advances that the Meerkat team has done is in constructing the dishes. So unlike having either wire mesh or metal dishes, they've gone for essentially fiberglass dishes. So they built a mold, and that's the one segment of the mold. That's the mold coming together, a completed mold, and then they create sheets of fiberglass, having some resin infusion over that, the steel backing structure going onto it, and then eventually you have lift off. Then this mold can go and be reused in the next issue. And so if this performs as to the specifications that we think it should, it will be a very quick and cheap alternative for production of SCA dishes. Whereas the Australians, for their array, their dishes are being manufactured in China and then shipped over to Australia. And that's the dish made from first dish going from the shed to the access road, and then being lifted up, going onto the pedestal. Apparently, this is a very tricky maneuver because this is 12 meters in diameter, and any little bit of breeze that comes on sort of shakes this thing. So they have to wait for an absolutely still day in the Karoo to be able to lift these dishes up onto the pedestal. And that's the first completed Meerkat or Cat 7 dish. So it's very satisfying for the engineers going from this design in the computer up to the real thing. And currently we have this first 7 dishes that will be used for lots of engineering testing. And hopefully in a few months they will allow some of our scientists to use it as well. As I said, at the moment it's still, this is controlled from the crew, so you have to drive there, fly out to Carnarvon. I think if they're working on having a remote access control, that's a control room in Pinelands. You can see there's a webcam on the site and all the controls from the various computers over there. been innovative with the dish design. There's also been some advancements in the electronics hardware. This is what's known as a approach board that's used to analyze the radio signals coming from the antenna. It's part of the Casper collaboration, which was the idea sort of the University of California, Berkeley. They asked the Meerkat team to get involved with some testing, and eventually the Meerkat team actually took quite a bit of the lead in this. They play a very important role. As you can see, there's a construction of one of those first boards. It has the UC Berkeley emblem on, as well as the Meerkat project as well. And currently, you can find these boards also all over the world. The outlook for the Meerkat, the timeline, so that the design phase is between now and 2013, the antenna prototype. So this is for the Meerkat, the full Meerkat, not the Cat 7. So the antenna prototyping, which because these antennas will be different from the current Cat 7 antennas. So it will be the first prototype run by 2013, and then have 6 months of testing. Then they'll go on with from 2013 to 2014 constructing the full array. They'll be doing this commissioning in parallel, and hopefully we can get to the first sites with this sub-array done in 2015. Okay. So a very important part of this is the South African government has channeled a lot of money into this project. A very important part of this is the human capital development. So they have this human capital development program, which started in 2005. So in 2005, they've given grants and fellowships, about 9 grants and fellowships. Currently to date, over 300 students and postdoctoral fellows have been funded. They funded academic positions at universities, they are visiting professorships, and also, I think, 5 research chairs. So these research chairs are research with positions based at universities. And there's a very significant attempt to get these African partners involved and trained up as well. So, as I said, lots of students, postdoctorals, fellowships, and undergraduates, so not only that, lots of internships and technical training at universities of technology. There's been artisan training, and also development of astronomy and astrophysics in African partner countries, and mobility grants for people to travel to meetings and so forth. So these are a picture every year. In December they have this student conference, a workshop. Initially it was held on the grounds at the South African Astronomical Observatory. That venue became a bit too small, and then they moved out to a venue in Stellenbosch. As you can, I don't know if it's that easy to see, but there has been a significant increase in the number of people attending these workshops. And I think I'll get there. This is actually taken from a site in the UK called comparethemeerkat.com. It's actually, I think, a car insurance website. But they have this Meerkat on their store as well. And so I think it's really going to be a journey of courageousness if you're going to get there scared. Thank you. I'm open to take questions. Those who would like to leave, Biscay. There are some rumours going about, and the way that could happen is that because you have this different arrays, so you have the dishes and you have this aperture arrays looking at different frequency regions, that, you know, conceivably South Africa could get, say, that the dish array and Australia could get this aperture arrays, and from that way we could share the data.
Yeah. communications and your whole fiber optics and feeding information back into Cape Town and Washington Centre.
So that would all have to be via fiber optics and possibly below ground. Laying these fibers below ground. And there are negotiations in place with companies like Google and a number of these companies that are laying these fiber optics. This is not good.
Two satellites like GPS and DSTV and others not interfere with this radio device.
Oh yes, they do. Satellites are increasingly becoming a problem as well. And so there are actually some bands, frequency bands, where you have to cut out, where the data is essentially unusable. So you just have to cut out that frequency range completely. And I don't know how, I mean, you either going to have to try and convince these satellite consortia to try and none of these things we're talking about have much success, but we're going to try to find clever ways of mitigating some of those signals from space. But you are correct, so these satellite signals are a huge problem as well. And probably will increasingly be some. No, as far as I'm aware, it shouldn't be a problem.
Casper Ridge boards, could they be manufactured here? Do we have the capacity?
To be honest, I don't know. I'm sure we do have the capability of manufacturing them in terms of it's more cost efficient. So lots of it. Design was in South Africa, the design of these.
And the other thing, what are the implications for our threat of fracking? If we won this, would that save us from fracking?
I don't think anything can really save us from people in our community. But, at least in our opinion, that act has been passed and that should really protect us. There'd be lots of political wrangle in order for people to go and explore those regions. But that's all remains to do.
With Meerkat, are they only using dishes or will they be using rectangular reflecting mirrors as well?
Meerkat's only using dishes.
Is there any plan to use the reflecting mirrors?
No. So, for mirrors, those will be mirrors we'd use in optical or infrared astronomy. And for radio astronomy, you don't need, your surface does not have to be as smooth and as reflective as in the optical regime. Okay.
I'm a member of the Harmonious Astronomy Club. I know that sounds a bit, nobody's ever heard of it, but we have a very good cosmology section as well. I've been up to Canada, we spent a week in the canal. But Deborah came out and spoke to us on a couple of occasions. She was saying that she reckons that we've got a 70% chance of getting 70% of the thing, with 30% going to Australia, and it was all going to be divided up into bundles, business rates.
Yes.
That's what she said, but I mean, she says they've got, 3,500 graduates in training, from technicians through to postdoctoral graduates, So they're also offering bursaries for technology students.
That's correct.
And it's kind of putting a lot of money into it.
The,
there is the government has, or is putting a lot of money into it.
A lot of it's US money as well. Some of these grants.
Yes, there are a number of international grants and funding from other sources as well. Do you want?
I have a party.
Well, I'm addicted to so many wonderful things.
Well, there's quite a few people here today.
Was that Ken Marshall?
I wouldn't have thought so.
Okay.
But I don't know. I stopped at the observatory yesterday. But, yeah.
I was wondering.
He's doing fine. I'll do that.
I think I must contact you some other time. I don't think we've got time to talk about it, but I was in the research laboratories in the Johannesburg Chamber of Mines, and we were measuring the size of dust particles by coating the dust particles in writing in the apertures. We shone light through the apertures, and what we found was, just as a Yagi antenna has a signal-to-noise, increases the signal-to-noise ratio, the same thing happens with visible light. If you've got an aperture that's the same size as the wavelength, light that would not hit the aperture actually bends in. It's actually, if this, the photons tell the photons next to it, hey, you don't have to hit solid ground, come in through the hole here, and the light bends in. The strange thing is, if you work out the decibel gain, it's very similar to the golden ratio squared. So the golden ratio determines the angle at which the light can bend in. And you get, just by having, instead at your focal point, would you have a Yagi, small Yagis, to pick it up? What will you have?
To be honest, I don't know.
It's more a radio problem. Who's the best person to talk to? Just might be something that they could think about.
Yeah, so the people would be within the...
Doing the electronic side.
I'm trying to think who would be... I'm not sure if I know anybody in the
Boss office. Man is Fanaroff.
Yeah, he's Bernie Fanaroff is in. He's the project manager of the entire project. In terms of the electronics, I think somebody like, I don't know if you know, Professor Mike Ings, I think he's up at UCT. Mike Ings.
Ings.
Yeah, I-N-G-S. Yeah. If he's not the person, he should be able to refer you to somebody within the.
But have you heard of this effect that a light beam can...
A lensing.
It's not like a lensing, gravitational lensing. It seems to be...
No, but it's... Well... Lensing is a form of gravitational. Yeah,
that's a gravitational where you get the light bending in. But this is simply on Earth here that the light coming down, that's the only explanation we came up with, that if the aperture is the same side as the wavelength and for frequencies either side of it to a certain extent, it bends in and gives you a huge gain with no other expenditure or complication that you're making your aperture the same size of the wavelength. So if you want 21 centimeters, you make a hole of 21 centimeters, and the wavelength, so 21 centimeter radiation will be focused, it's self-focusing without any lenses or Fresnel lenses or anything like that. It seems to focus. Yeah. And it proved that the idea, it wasn't my idea originally, of evaporating aluminium over it, and it wasn't my idea. It was an optics guy. So I actually left it then. I thought, no, this is above me. I can't explain it. Yeah. And I left it up to him, but unfortunately he didn't carry on to find out what the reason was.
So you could have you could have the area.
21 centimeters.
You can get the emission from that whole area focused down onto...
Yes, onto your whatever system you're using now. So it'd be worthwhile because they're using these... In the military planes, instead of having Yagi sticking out in the wings, they have apertures in the bodywork. And ordinary radio waves are actually, if it's the right size, length of aperture, it acts just like a solid Yagi. So they talked about this.
Yeah. If you... There might be somebody in the office that might know.
Either say, yeah, it's, it doesn't work at all, or it has been tried and doesn't work, or nobody's tried.
Give me
a...
If you give me your details, I can maybe try and get some
names
to you. I
have other questions, but I thought it would be...
Any other questions? Just have your contact details.
Should I write it down for you?
No.
I'm going to check if I have a card.
No, if you've got a card.
You're at UCT. So
I'm at UCT.
But you work closely with the observatory, don't you?
That's right. I don't have a card. Sorry.
ASC, is it?
ASC, sorry.
ASC. T.
For astronomy.
Is it G?
ASC, that's it.
Tell me, if everything was shared with Australia, would you still be able to do interferometry? Because isn't the whole idea there that, forget the resolution, all the dishes have to be looking at the same object at the same time?
That's right.
Well,
but if they share the frequency range, and so you'd have essentially half the area, or more than half the area in one site, and the other half looking at a different frequency range, and on the other side you could share it that way.
Would that not make it more expensive from the infrastructure point of view?
It probably will, whereas if you could share power, if it was all in one site, you could share, all have the same power infrastructure and communication infrastructure.
But would it turn out to be a...
You doubled those costs.